This episode of Tales from the Lot is sponsored by ShakedownT-Shirts.com with unique lot style t-shirts, license plate frames, coffee mugs, and all sorts of things for Grateful Dead, Fish, Zappa, Panic, and more. ShakedownT-Shirts.com, where all U.S. orders over $35 ship free. And just for Tales from the Lot listeners, use the code LOT20 for 20% off of any order. That's LOT20. Hey, real quick, before we kick off this episode of Tales from the Lot, I've got some exciting news to share with you. I've been working on a project called Summer Tour The Game, inspired by our love of following our favorite bands around. It's a tabletop board game where you chase shows, collect ticket stubs, and relive the magic of live music, all from your own tabletop. I'm thrilled to announce that the Kickstarter campaign for Summer Tour The Game is launching on May 12th. If you're a fan of this podcast, then I think you're really going to enjoy this game. You can check out a short video and all the details at summertourthegame.com. So whether you're a seasoned road warrior or a tabletop gaming enthusiast or just looking for a new way to connect with friends, I invite you to check out the campaign and consider supporting it. Every pledge and share and word of encouragement makes a difference. I'd love it if you would help spread the word and make Summer Tour The Game a reality. Thank you, everyone, for listening and being a part of this journey, and now on with the episode. Tales from the Lot, Episode 1, last tour of the show. My guest Steve Butler is here to discuss 4390 at the Omni. Let's do this. Hi, and welcome to Tales from the Lot. My guest this episode is Steve Butler. He saw quite a few shows on the Spring 90 tour. He's here to talk specifically about the Omni show on 4390, which was, I think it was the final tour of the show, but he saw quite a few on that tour. We'll talk about all of it. Welcome, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. A little bit of history. Steve and I go back a bit. I think we first met maybe Buckeye Lake 93, and you were selling some sort of weird banana split take.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Crap, what the hell was it? Banana subs?
Something like, yeah. I remember it being very bizarre, and then getting one, it was delicious. We talked for a while, and then went our way. And then about 10 years later, we ended up working together. And figuring all this out again, and have been friends since.
Yep.
So, you know, tell me, how did you? Well, let's start at the beginning. Where did you come from? And like high school, middle school, what were you into?
Honestly, I didn't really have any kind of musical identity until after my brother died. He was 3 years younger than me. I inherited all of his records, so lots of metal, lots of Kiss, lots of Aerosmith, lots of AC/DC, Black Sabbath. So that was my musical identity until I got into high school, and then it just started spreading. I mean, I got into jazz, I got into blues, I got into Yes. I didn't really get into the Dead until I was in college and I was at a party, and I didn't like Deadheads. They freaked me out. But I was at a party, and the party was really lousy. And I saw this album, Anthem of the Sun, and I thought, well, I'll just throw the headphones on, smoke a joint, and listen to this. And I was hooked. There are so many layers of sound in that record. And I was just, I had to turn it over and like, oh my God, there's another side with all the different stuff. And I listened to it again, and people were like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm listening to Anthem of the Sun. It's like, oh no, you should listen to American Beauty. And I listened to American Beauty, I'm like, this isn't even the same band.
Yeah. Completely and different.
This is what I was really into. So after that, it was trying to find tapes from the 70s and collecting those and listening to those. I really didn't like their studio albums. I mean, American Beauty's nice. It's pretty. So was Working Man's Dead. Mars Hotel has kind of a gloss to it. Wake of the Flood has some great tunes, but it's kind of lifeless.
Yeah, yeah. They tried a lot of different things, it seems like. I mean,
oh yeah,
and they were changing and morphing.
Studio albums.
Yeah,
their best one was probably In the Dark, and that's because it was recorded live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as far as anything after,
say, yeah, yeah,
Working Man's Dead.
Yeah, I mean, and even you know, Go to Heaven was bad. Shakedown Street with Lil George was, but all the songs came to life when they were performed live. Because there was something about a Dead show, and Bill Graham has said this, you know, they're not the best at what they do. They're the only ones that do what they do. Indeed. And it's true. I mean, you can go to a Dead show, and you're not going to see the same show twice. You're just not. And it's there are going to be moments where it's just absolute bliss. And then there's moments like, oh my God, what the hell was that?
Totally.
Get them in the same 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You just kind of go, okay, we're moving right along.
Yeah, you just jump on for the ride and see exactly. Where it takes you. So exactly. were you living in Ohio area at the
Ohio,
time?
Ohio. Went to school at Ohio State. Didn't really like all the touch heads. Started going to shows in 84. Saw the Akron Rubber Bowl. That was right before... Is that before Garcia's first diabetic coma? It was hot. It was humid. Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, The Grateful Dead.
Super lineup.
It was a great lineup. The performance was It was okay. And then I didn't see another show until 85. I saw one in Riverbend. And then 86 was kind of a wash. And then Garcia came back late in 87, and I started seeing shows again in 88. Saw Buckeye Lake. It was the first Buckeye Lake show. That was hot.
And I'm thinking, it's always hot at Buckeye Lake.
Always hot at Buckeye Lake. Yeah. Great venue, though.
Yeah.
And 89 really started to pick up. 90 saw most of spring tour, a fair amount of fall tour. 91 saw a lot of spring tour. Most of summer tour, some of fall tour. I saw a lot of 90 summer tour as well. 90 was a great year.
Yeah, I didn't catch him till 91. Deer Creek 91 was my first one. Hornsby was there, so there was a lot of sound coming off the stage, and it was.
You could compare the 90 tours to 72, 74, 77. I mean, they were that quality of shows. They were just. They enjoyed being on stage together. I mean, the shows weren't long. They weren't like marathon shows. But, man, they were played well.
And you know, it has to do, I think, with the people, you know, where it got to where Jerry and Brent were just so locked in.
Yes,
I think when that happens, the rest of the band just follows along and it's on
fire. Well, that was true with Jerry and Bruce. Lock in and just lose the rest of the band. It's like, we don't know.
Yeah, but they would ride along and keep.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah,
great stuff. So, so you did a bunch on the spring tour, and the final one was at the Omni. Who did you have a whole crew with you? Were you?
No. It was a very small group. It was my brother. We drove in his LeCar stick, and he drove it to Nantucket, and it didn't make it back. But that was after the fact. I could barely drive a stick, so I didn't do a lot of the driving. Another guy that went with us was Brett Mullet. I have no idea where he is. Brett, if you're listening, hi. he sat in the back seat and just pretty much smoked dope and fed his tapes. We listened to a lot of 80s shows and a lot of 77 shows.
Yeah, you got to have that friend, though.
There's
always that guy.
Like, tape.
Yeah. It is a duty tape. Tape. Yeah. It's cool. And then so you guys rolled in. What's the Omni like? I've been to Atlanta. I never made it to a show at the Omni.
Security on the floor sucks. It's really tight. Security in every other place in the venue is not so bad. The Omni is in the CNN complex. So it's like this one big, huge building. And CNN has their offices there. And there's like a little mall area just outside of the Omni Arena. There is a couple spaces up above that people had come down and dubbed them the fill zones, where the bass was just vibrating like crazy.
Just gather there.
Yeah, that was like going, I'd really love to go up, but we've got really good seats. I'm not going anywhere. The first night, we were sitting four rows back on Jerry's side on the floor, which was just breathtaking.
Yeah.
My friend Matt Steffen's brother-in-law owned a record store in Atlanta, and he got us tickets. The other two nights, we were at the back of the floor, up on a riser, facing the stage, and they were great seats. I made tapes of all three nights, and they were okay. The first night was kind of like too loud and distorted. The second night was pretty good, and the third night, we got some really good stuff, and it was just kind of a mess.
Did you have tapered tickets? Or were you just...
The tickets, we had tickets for all three nights. there was talk in the lot that the tour was going so well, they were going to do two more shows in Miami, and people were already making plans to go to Miami. And I'm like, nah, that's not going to happen.
Nah, they'll let you know.
There was also rumors in the lot that they were going to do Unbroken Chain because everyone's chains were breaking. And I'm like, nah, they're not going to do Unbroken Chain. Nah. But the shows themselves, I mean, every night had had something really, really special about it. The first night, everything after Althea in the first set, you had Althea, Victim of the Crime, To Lay Me Down, Music Never Stop. That ended the first set. The Stella Blue in the second set was just beautiful. It was perfect. The second night, first set was eh. We got the last Death Don't Have No Mercy out of the other one, out of Space.
Very nice.
That was the encore is Black Muddy River, and Jerry was just on fire. The third night, and it's the third night at the end of a tour, is always, they're always pumped up because after this, they're going home. So they're going to throw everything they have on the stage, and everybody in the audience knew that. And we got there early. The second night, we were walking around the CNN Mall, and I think it was Easter on April 1st. And, you know, people had Easter eggs and everything. And someone's walking through the CNN Mall with some sticks, and they're beating out Not Fade Away.
Right.
Of course, as they walk through the mall, people are starting to pick it up with a little clap and the chant, Love is Real, Not Fade Away. And then you got people on the other side going, Not Fade Away. And I say, no, Not Fade Away. And pretty soon, everybody's singing this, and the CNN staff are coming out and watching all this. And we kept this going for a good 10, 15 minutes. These girls were just walking up and down, you know, beating out the Not Fade Away beat, and we were all just chiming in. And when it broke up, we all just kind of gave ourselves a round of applause. That's what we were doing.
Yeah, and but I feel like the you know, the lot scene and the kind of things that happened at those original Grateful Dead shows haven't translated as much
days. No. There was I want to say that there was an innocence that was pre-internet, didn't have cell phones. You had to rely on word of mouth. You had to rely on meeting somebody in the lot if you needed a ride. You had to know where your resources were. I mean, Wavy Gravy always had his rainbow bus at Ridgefield and at the Spectrum and at Landover. So if you knew somebody that was having a hard time, you got into him and he would carry you. You also had to know where the wharf rats were. So if someone was having a hard time, you could get them to him. And I think that there was a place where you could go and put your name down if you needed a ride, and you just check at the end of the night. See who said, hey, I've got this. I'm at lot B4. Come look for me.
Certainly.
You also had the tapers that really didn't like to be accosted after the show. But, you know, if you were like bold enough to go, dude, that was a great show. You got to get me a tape. Here's my address. Here's some blanks. Here's some postage. There you go.
Right. Yeah. Anytime, but not all the time.
Right. Maybe it may take 2 or 3 months, but your tapes would come in the mail. And, yeah.
That was a great day.
But this the third night, the opener was Shakedown Street, and it was just rocking. I mean, they were just on. And all three nights, Brett and Jerry just kept getting better and better and better. Shakedown went into Hell in the Bucket. Hell in the Bucket went into Sugary, and then from there, it's like Just a Little Light. Wrote Jimmy, Tennessee Dead. It's just one thing after another, and it was just, oh my God, this is incredible.
So we can run, specifically We Can Run.
Yeah, we can.
That happened in the first set, and you know, I was listening through this show, and there's We Can Run, and there's also Throwing Stones later, and
second set.
Yeah, and so it made me realize, you know, they were very into the earth and sort of forward thinking, and
yes.
Another thing that I feel like has not translated as much forward. I mean, I felt like we had something started there that maybe didn't Brent, turn out.
I think Brent's songs towards the end were actually pretty damn good, and they were heartfelt, and they were, I mean, you could look at We Can Run and say that it's a campfire song.
Yeah.
One of the other songs that got played that night was I Will Take You Home, which has become a favorite of my daughter's, because I used to play it for her when she was little. Mm-hmm. And when she turned 18, I made her like a mix on Spotify, and I put that on there, and she loves it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
that.
Interesting song choice, I felt like, in this show for where it came. You know,
right.
It would have been maybe nice to have like a play and reprise out of there, or
maybe
some other one or something. Trucking.
Opening the second set with Estimated was completely, we're like, whoa, we're going to start with this. And then everyone thought it was going to go into Eyes, and then it doesn't. It goes into Scarlet, and then it goes into Crazy Fingers, and then it goes into Playing. And you're just like, oh, we're just making stuff up now.
yeah, for sure. Like, that whole first set, though, was just like a rock fest, and then Promised Land. And, and I got to say, like, Tennessee Jed specifically, the whole first set specifically, I don't know if it was just the recording I listened to or what, but the crowd was just like...
Oh, the crowd was into it.
Full on. The Tennessee Jed, the first couple of notes, I've never heard a crowd react like that to Tennessee Jed.
Well, Jerry gave him a verse.
Yeah. He just stopped singing for a minute, and you guys are just like...
We knew what we were doing.
Indeed. Yeah, the crowd was on fire that night as well.
Well, and that's, I think that when, and I haven't seen Dead & Company, but I do remember the shows that were really, really good are shows where the crowd was really into it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there is definitely a dynamic, an energy feedback between the crowd and the band. If the band's off and the crowd's on, the crowd can kick the band in gear. If the crowd is off and the band is on, that can also work the same way. But if both parties are just off, and that happened a lot, 92, 93, 94, 95 was a train wreck.
Yeah.
Sadly, the last show was 94, and I couldn't do it.
I saw a ton of shows. I saw almost the whole summer tour in 94, and was pleased. I mean, it wasn't that bad. There were some really good moments. I thought Deer Creek had some really fine moments. The wave at Soldier Field was, you know, like it's set break, and it's literally the best wave you've ever seen.
Yeah, I could.
Better than any Bears game.
Right.
And then, so then 95, I didn't see a whole lot. I was in my own band kind of touring around and messing around, but I was at Deer Creek, and... So they tore the fence down, the Death Threat, and I had tickets for Soldier Field, and I sold my tickets. I'm like, you know, I feel like maybe I'm going to take a little time off because, you know, obviously Jerry was having some problems at that time, and it was really coming through, and you know, unfortunately I didn't make it to those Soldier Field shows, and wish I had, but
I mean, my last show, my first song was Let the Good Times Roll. And my last song was It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
Yeah.
So that, I figured that's a pretty good, it's like, okay, so we got a good, I mean, there was a good 65, 75 shows in there, spread over 10 years. And they're all, with the exception of one or two, they were all gems.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel very fortunate.
The ones you're at are always gems too.
So. Oh yeah, the space during that night was Healy pulled out all the stops. I don't know if you could hear it on your recording, but he was panning left and right, you know, slow down sounds, weird stereo effects.
I actually made some notes about what unique sounds and like just things you didn't typically hear. And even in the drum segment, you know, it took a minute to get it together. But once they did, it's like, wow, this is...
Mickey at one point was standing on his drums, jumping up and down. There was like a bar up above, and he's standing up, and he's just got his feet, and he's pounding up and down on his drums. And Billy's over there just looking at him going, all right, man, whatever. You know.
Billy's going, cocaine's a hell of a drug.
I mean, when the band came back out, and... I mean, there was a really nice exploration of different sounds. And I mean, even going into I Will Take You Home, Jerry had dialed in his MIDI, and there was this nice
oboe.
Brent had like the tinkle sounds on his keyboard, and the rest of the band just knew, okay, we're going to leave these guys to do this. Mm-hmm. They just kind of sat out a little bit.
Yeah. And all night, I mean, starting even like with the Sugary, there's this moment where like Brent's really just on fire, uh-huh. and Jerry just starts adding in all these flourishes just yep. over what he's doing. Yep. And it's like, yep. man, those dudes are locked in tonight. And I did officially name this the Ha Show, because you got, you got yep. Held a Bucket, you got Estimated, yep. you got, yep. there was another one Picasso Moon. Plenty of Ha's going on all night long. So Bobby was feeling it that night and rocking out too.
Yeah, and I've heard him do that before, but he's never done it quite as well as he did that night.
Yeah, that was a good one, you know. And that masterpiece, I thought, I feel like there's two types of masterpiece. There's the normal one,
right?
And then there's the one where Jerry sings, you know, like where Bobby's like, "When I pay," and then Jerry's like, "When I pay." He didn't always do that, but when he did, it just like it would just take it at that next level and make an everyday masterpiece, a true masterpiece.
I think that the feeling after the show, and I mean, people were just hugging each other after the show. It was just one of those moments. And all the thoughts of Miami were just gone. It's like, no, you're not going to top that. You're not going to, you know, that is the perfect tour closer. And I think they knew that they had a really good tour. They were really on. I think Jerry was feeling clean. I think the band was locked in. Again, it was kind of like you took the spring tour, and it was like that week in May in 1977 where they just could do no wrong. Mm-hmm. This entire tour was like that. If you look at the Hops Coliseum in Ontario, the Scarlet Fire from there is just immaculate. Mm-hmm. The Nassau shows with Branford were just on fire. I mean, that was when everyone realized that the Grateful Dead are musicians. They can actually play some stuff. And people started to take notice and like, oh, they're not just a bunch of stoners. I mean, mm-hmm. Branford came out of going, these guys are hot.
Yeah. I mean,
I can play with these guys.
Yeah. That was when they got together, that was just incredible.
Like, yeah. And it was a random phone call.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in the area, you know. I was like, oh, you want to come play with us? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll come hang out for a couple songs.
Yeah.
And we did the Bert song, which really should have been on the Without a Net. The Eyes of the World is a classic, although it's been overplayed. The Dark Star is...
No, you had Without a Net, and you played it too much.
I know. I did.
Who didn't, though? Like, that Feel Like a Stranger on there, like, that whole thing's really good.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of songs on there from the Atlanta one.
Yeah.
It's from there. China Writer is from there. Althea is from there.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that run offered up a few gems.
Yeah, that helps slip Franklin on there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. From Landover?
Yeah.
Landover or Albany?
I used to know that stuff, but I forgot about it. I haven't looked at my copy of Without a Net for a while.
I said, Dozing at the Nick.
Mm-hmm.
It took three nights and just crammed it into one perfect show.
Yeah. It's good stuff. You know, and you were talking about Branford when he showed up. He ended up, after that, ended up on Hornsby's album, Harbor Lights. Are you familiar with that?
Yep.
Fantastic album. And the song they do on there, I can't remember what it's called, but I think it's the only one that Branford's on. But it's got the Dark Star lit going through it.
Yeah. It's not Spider Fingers, is it?
Maybe. I can't remember. No, Spider Fingers, I think, was the next album. Maybe.
Maybe. No, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's got it's just hints of the Dead all through that album, but specifically Branford locks onto that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- That blew me away, by the way. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, being a huge Zappa fan, Vinny Colaiuta was there.
Yep.
I was like 20 feet from the stage, and like, yeah, that was
Yeah.
Sting in the Dead. That was my
And
jam that
they
day.
were like, so should I be the opening band? Bradford's like, oh yeah. Yeah, you need to be the opening band. Yeah, you're gonna dig this. The crowd is gonna dig you, and the crowd did.
Yeah, I mean, everybody I saw was into it. He played a great set. At the end of my Buckeye tape, I had a bit of his set and was able to, but I listened to it. But I haven't been able to find it online, and I have long since lost my Buckeye tape.
Yeah, so. I've lost a lot of my tapes too. They've been in the garage, and heat, cold, heat, cold, heat, cold. They snap.
Yeah, indeed.
The back half of that night after Space, I've never heard anything better than that.
No, I mean, that's that from We Can Run to Going Down the Road.
All the way to the end.
All the way to the end.
And I still, I mean, when I was listening to the show, I got goosebumps when the crowd kept going with Not Fade Away chant. Mm-hmm. And then the band came out and did We Bid You Goodnight. There was no other closer that was going to do it that night. That was
for sure. For sure. And that yeah. Not Fade Away had some power. Like, they yeah. Really, I mean, like really giving it something there. And
well, I mean, you had I Will Take You Home and the Going Down the Road Feeling Bad and the Throwing Stones and the Not Fade Away. And then that was it. And then the crowd kept it going. And then you had We Bid You Goodnight. It, I mean, we just went, okay, that's a wrap.
yeah. No other way to do it. So yeah, I'm listening to it. I never got a Bid You Goodnight, but the ones I've heard, I always hear Jerry strumming a little bit. So, you know, I assume he came out with his guitar. And,
He did.
Bobby and Phil, were they?
Bobby came out with his guitar, but it was behind his back. Phil came out without his bass.
Yeah.
Drummers came out from behind the kit, and they sang, and Brent was right next to Jerry.
Yeah. So, so the drummers came out and kicked in, too. Eh?
Yep.
Wow, very cool.
They're all right there, and they all, like, you know, the crowd was not going to let him go. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is rousing applause for a good 5-10 minutes. And, you know, they took a bow and they left and they came back out. And they kind of waved everybody again and they left. And the crowd was like, oh, come on back out. And they're like, nope, that's it. We're done. We're
it's
gone.
The last night. It's the last night. Come on.
So house lights came on and we're like, okay. So we went back to my cousin's house. We stayed at his house in Alpharetta, I think. Alpharetta or Cumming. Can't remember. Atlanta was weird then. I didn't really realize how deeply racist Atlanta still was in 1990. Mm-hmm. It was bad.
The only time I've been there, it was probably 88. I went there to see a baseball game. My dad was really into baseball games, so I went to see the Braves and the Cubs play, and yeah, I don't have a whole lot of recollection. It was hot. That was my memory.
It was very humid. It was springtime, so it was kind of cool. I mean, it was so warm during the day, but it was cool at night. But normally, when deadheads travel around the country, they see the long hair, they see the tie dyes, they see the dreads, they see the bare feet, whatever, and they instantly think, oh my God, get these people out of here. We were waiting in line at a restaurant, and we got seated before a family of four, an African-American family. Mm. And they were there before us. So we got seated, and we're like, this isn't right. Mm. And my friend, we ran into a guy, Scott, that was there. And he was like, going, I got this. So he gets up, and he goes back, and he's talking to the family. And, he comes back, he's like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to order, and then we're going to get up and leave, and they're going to come in. And I'm like, well, that's brilliant. So we ordered what they wanted.
Nice.
And then we just got up and left and told them, no, there's a table. And when the waitress came back with the food, they were already there. And she was very confused.
Yeah, sure.
And we're still waiting to see. And Scott was like, wait, do we really want to eat here? And I'm like, oh, no, we probably don't.
Especially after that, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, like, well, they're going to spit in our food, or they're going to piss out, or. But it was that was odd. I mean, I didn't get that in Chicago because we saw the last three nights of Summer Tour in Chicago, and that was Brent's last show, and it wasn't nearly as good as the last night in Atlanta, but there was that same energy. But man, Brent was troubled that night, July 23rd, 1990. It's a good show, but it's dark.
Yeah, it's Tinley Park, right?
Tinley Park, yeah. And they also, It rained the first night. We didn't have tickets, and we sat out on the grassy knoll, and they stormed the gates, and some guy tried to get his motorbike, his mountain bike over, and the fence had, like, serrated edge, and mm-hmm. it's pouring down rain, and the crowd is pulling him on this side, and the security's pulling him on this side. This kid is stuck. Oh. And they had to get a ladder and lift him up and then get him on the stretcher, and by the next night, the fence was all roped off, and you couldn't get up there, and yeah, it was bad. Security got beefed up. Everyone, all the security cops are wearing Woodstock shirts. And I had to tell one security guy, I'm like, well, you know, we all know that you're security because you're wearing a Woodstock shirt. New Woodstock shirt.
Yeah, brand new.
They didn't have shirts at Woodstock.
No.
So he's like, oh, they didn't? I'm like, no. There were no shirts on sale at Woodstock in 68. Were you there? No. No. But there were...
He was like 20 years old.
Yeah. Like I was two. No, I was six in 68.
I wasn't quite there yet, but I saw the movie.
Yeah, there you go. The movie was good. But yeah, yeah. The thing that I think that, I mean, you've seen shows, and the people that are seeing the shows now, what really, and I've talked to my friend Evan about this, the thing about the shows now is that it's all about a jam. It's all about the noodling. The odd thing is, the thing about the shows then, when it was the Grateful Dead, is that here you had this little anarchist on stage in the form of Jerry Garcia that didn't really want to follow any rules, but he gave structure to everything. Mm-hmm. It was a Bobby song, a Jerry song, a Brent song, a Phil song, or it was a Bobby song, a Jerry song, a Bobby song, a Jerry song. And then Brent would go in there, and then Phil would sing, and it's, you had, within the song, you had the potential for a long jam if one presented itself, but you didn't force it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were locked in and you felt something, and, you know, if Weir heard something and he would come up with like a couple weird chord flourishes, and Phil would like tromp all over it and play lead for a while, and but it was never like it was in 74 when Phil just played lead. He played bass. That was it.
You know, even this show, it's like, you know, I was really noticing Phil, you can count on Phil to be on the one.
Yes.
And he'll be on the one again, but who the hell knows where he's going to be in between those ones.
Exactly.
You know, it's just all over the place, but he's going to hit that one for you. He's
I got the one, but after that, it's mine. My circuit.
Yeah, he's been listening to a lot of P-Funk or something. He's like, everything's on the one.
I think that this was a band that, if you look back at their career, you could say that the best thing that they ever did was that they listened to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And the last couple years, when they got the in-the-ear monitors and they got to hear their own mix, they lost that. That went away, and I noticed that the shows were kind of flat. There wasn't that intuitiveness that existed. I don't actually know if they had planned the second set on April 3rd. Mm-hmm. I think they had estimated, and after that it was like, I don't know, whatever happens. Mm-hmm. But from Estimated to Scarlet to Crazy Fingers to Playin', I've never seen that combination since.
Yeah, and the smoothest transition too. Like,
oh, God, yeah.
From the Crazy Fingers to the Playin'.
Yep. Little rocking...
Exactly. Yeah, where it's like a downward.
Yeah.
That was really cool. Again, something you don't hear a whole lot from.
No, you don't. That's because they were listening to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were locked in. And being there, you could see, you'd see like the side glimpse of Garcia looking over at Weir, or Brent's like, you know, looking over at the band going, okay, so I'm really going to jump on the keys here in a minute, but not just yet. There was a moment during Road Jimmy that something, I think Jerry dialed in a weird MIDI sound. It just kind of dropped. This tempo just dropped.
Yes.
Like this 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Picked back up again. And we're like, wait, did we all hear that?
I was mesmerized listening back to it. I was mesmerized by that. I was casually listening, and then that happened, and I'm just like,
yeah, yeah,
what's going on here?
Yeah, we were all like that.
Just as quick, it was gone. You know,
it was gone. Yeah,
yeah. Like,
"Road Jimmy" is one of those songs that Jerry really liked to play.
Yeah,
I mean, everyone thought, well, that's a bathroom break. I'm like, no, this is what it is. And honestly, the Stella Blue on the first night, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah.
That was, and being four rows back and seeing the sweat glisten on his forehead and the emotion in his face, that was, and there's always that moment in Stella Blue, and I know it exists in other songs, but there is a moment of perfect silence mm-hmm. where he bends the note, just hangs, mm-hmm. and then it just cascades away. And when he does it right, there's nothing better.
Yeah, totally. That between that and Standing on the Moon, I think.
Just
so good. So yep. I mean, there are tons of great Jerry ballads, I guess. But
oh yeah,
those are my two.
Make a whole show about that.
Or So Many Roads.
Oh yeah,
killer one.
Crazy River Road is a great.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. So many. I am one of those bathroom break Road Jimmy guys, though.
God, what song was it that I just absolutely hated? Oh, it was Long Way to Go Home.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of those in 94.
Oh, I heard A Wave to the Wind, and I'm like, no, never, ever again.
Oh.
Never want to hear that song again.
No.
And I didn't really like it when Phil sang.
Box of Rain was good.
Box of Rain was good. Unbroken Chain in the late and early 90s was no.
Pride of Cucamonga?
Four. No, I've heard one of those. It was, I mean, I heard a recording of that, and it was okay.
Yeah.
But the Unbroken Chain, honestly, if it hadn't been done in 74 or 77, it should never have been done.
No, it was definitely still broken, the chain.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The thing that makes that song work is the big jam in the middle.
Yeah.
And Jerry just didn't have it in him to do that anymore.
No, they didn't have the dexterity or the
nope.
Or the speed and the song itself right. to really get those changes to sound
right.
You know, moving like they did on right. the album. You know, or yeah, you know, they tried though. Do you think they did it because they wanted to or because of crowd pressure? What do you think?
Wanted to do it. I think Vince said, "Oh, we could do this, and we could do Here Comes Sunshine, and we can do this song." And Phil's like, "Yeah, why don't we just do Unbroken Chain? Yeah, we could do that too." And I think it was Vince was looking for anything that would get him some spotlight on the keyboard.
Yeah, yeah. Way to Go Home. And what's that other one?
Samba in the Rain.
Samba in the Rain, yeah. I liked that one better than Way to Go Home.
Yeah, yeah. The first time that I saw Vince was in Richfield. And Jerry introduced him. And he was okay. I really think they should have waited after Brett died. Mm-hmm. Given it like a tour to figure out somebody else. And then we saw him in Philadelphia.
Was Bruce on that spring tour also? No, or no. He didn't join until summer, right?
Bruce didn't join the spring tour until New York. But Vince was still there, and there was like three nights in Philly. You know that part in Sugar Magnolia where it stops?
Mm-hmm. And the Sunshine Daydream part?
They go into Sunshine Daydream.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like 18 rows up on the side on Jerry's side. And the song stops. And, you know, they're like playing it for effect. And the crowd's going nuts. Vince got up and left. He thought that was it. And Kid or one of the roadies had to go get him and bring him back. And Bobby's like sitting there going, "What?" And Jerry's like, "Come on, man."
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, well, that's a newbie mistake.
It is. It's too bad. You know, I liked Vince.
Vince was alright.
He had some interesting sounds. Did I read somewhere that he was kind of forced to use Brent stuff? Is that to keep that
sound? I don't know.
I may be wrong on that, but that could be. I'll look on Snopes.
They could have just done it with Bruce and just done a grand piano.
But I don't think Bruce wanted to be the Grateful Dead's keyboard player.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, Bruce did it as a favor, and he liked playing with Jerry.
Yeah, but he did. That wasn't going to be his gig.
No, and he stopped playing when he found out how deeply Jerry was back into the heroin. He said, "Look, you know, either stop that, or I stop playing with you."
Yeah.
And nope, sorry. All right, bye.
Yeah, and you know, maybe he would have. I don't know. Who knows if his career would have been any different? But he could have still done his solo albums. Who knows if they would have been the same or whatever? But
I think that Jerry would have been perfectly happy to spend the rest of his days being nothing but a side man.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would have just loved that.
However,
no on him, yeah.
But, however, JGB though, when he is the front man, I feel like his energy is a little bit higher.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, like, you're a JGB show next to a Dead show, and it's always great, but JGB, he's always a little bit higher, I feel like.
Right. There's one show that I really, really want to find and listen to. It's the only show where Jerry's played by himself. Garcia had horrible stage fright, and he didn't like going on tour. He didn't like going on stage. Bill Graham had booked several nights at a Broadway theater, and it was like Jerry and John Kahn. Mm-hmm. John Kahn couldn't make it that night, so Jerry had to go out by himself. And he played an hour and 15 minutes just by himself, and he came back, you know, like – played the last song. He's like, told Bill, he's like, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, I do remember. I think I had the tapes of those back in the day, and of that show. I remember listening to. There was maybe All Around This World, and
yep.
Some other stuff.
Good tunes, and make no mistake, Garcia had chops.
Yeah, no doubt.
He had the, I think he had the musical depth in the band. Bob Weir was your typical lead singer. Phil had a very eclectic jazz avant-garde bass. Mickey liked making noise. And Billy is one of the best rock and roll drummers out there. Take a look at the Grateful Dead movie. Bill Kreutzmann gets, you know, MVP for that movie.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's all over the place.
Yeah, and the girl that goes, woo, woo, woo.
I love her. Yeah, I love her too. And Brent, I think, brought as close as they were ever going to get to having Big Ted back in the band.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, he's right there with the organ, really. Yeah, for sure.
Sure. Yeah.
And his voice may have been slightly better than Pigpen's.
Yeah, but I mean, people kept comparing him to Michael McDonald. And I'm like, no, he's way rougher than Michael McDonald.
Oh, man.
He had a very good voice.
I do a great Michael McDonald. I'll do for you sometime.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah, he was great back in, you know, he was in the Doobie Brothers. He did a bunch of stuff with Christopher Cross too. So
that's okay. We don't need
Not that it's great, but yeah, he's been around a while.
Right.
He wrote songs. Didn't he write? Who did he write a song for? Michael McDonald showed up in the craziest place as songwriter one time. I can't remember what it was.
I want to say Paul Simon, but that's not it.
I think it might have been like a... I'm not going to say it. Some metal band, but I can't think of who it is.
Okay. he's a talented writer. He did stuff with Steely Dan.
Yeah. Who's still touring?
Right. I don't understand that.
Sort of. Yeah, I don't really.
It's like, there's one guy...
You know, well, that's Gene Simmons is saying, you know, if all of them die, Kiss will continue.
Yeah, okay.
Because the makeup is Kiss, supposedly.
Right.
And maybe that's just his way of playing off that he's got, you know, fake Ace and fake Peter Criss up there.
Right. Well, he's just marketing his brand.
It's true, but, you know, it's an interesting thought, though. I mean, what is to stop a band, you know, from doing that and just...
Duran Duran. No, not Duran Duran.
Yeah, they're all still alive.
Parker has one original member, and everybody else is like stand-ins.
What happens?
Toto's like that. It's like, okay, so there's like two guys. Creedence Clearwater Revival went on without John Fogerty. And I'm like, you can't really do that either.
Yeah, that's, he's kind of a key member.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. You know,
they're all their songs.
Yeah. You know, Bobby's tried it. I feel like, you know, when he did that Blue Mountain album.
Right. I love that album.
I feel like that was a good lane for him. And,
right.
And maybe it doesn't sell as well as, you know, whatever he's doing with Dead & Co. But man, it's fresh and it's new and it's
right.
Not the same song he's been playing since 1969.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, and that's, you know, I don't know. I feel like he had some fresh ideas there that he could have maybe built on.
Sure.
And
there was talk of him doing an album with Sammy Hagar, which would have been interesting.
Yeah. Sammy's surprisingly still out there kicking it, doing a lot of stuff. He's a busy guy.
He is a busy guy.
Yeah.
He's just, you know, living his best dream.
Yeah, the Red Rocker. You know.
Yep.
Cool. All right, so Omni, April 3rd, 90. Was it the music when?
Hear it.
What's that?
If you haven't heard the show, seek it out. Find it.
It is fantastic. And so, you know, you were tasked with picking a show and you picked this one. Was it the music? Was it the just the whole vibe? I mean, what was it that really?
It was the last night of a 3-night stand. And I think that gave it a little extra luster, but it was really, really, really a good performance.
Yeah.
And great set list.
Yeah.
I mean, I have not seen a set list better than that since.
No, when you first said it, I went and looked at the set list. I went on archive because I was going
right.
to stream it and check it out. And I'm looking, and it's not always easy to tell where the set break is on those lists. So I was looking, and I see Promised Land, so I assume that's the set that's break. Different. And then I saw Estimated Scarlet, and I'm like, oh, this has got to be wrong, you know. So
yeah.
I go bust out my dead bass, and I'm like, oh, okay, so this is yeah. gonna be fun. I'm looking forward to this one, and yeah, it was definitely a fantastic show. The set list definitely proved
the crowd was there, the band was there. I can't think of a better way to end a tour,
especially
a tour like that. That was an amazing tour.
Definitely, yeah. I'm gonna dig into the rest of it when I find time.
Oh, this yeah. week. All right, man.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve. Sure. I appreciate it. Let's not wait this long to get together again.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks.
See ya.
Hey, now. Do you have a great story about a Grateful Dead show you were at? I'd love to hear it and maybe have you on the podcast. Send me an email at will@talesfromthelot.org and let me know what show you would like to talk about and what made it so special to you.